You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
War, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is Heart of Glory. I'm James from London.
I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm the Klingon from Indiana, Kapla.
Yes, our guest. My goodness. Is that Dedimor?
Yes, it is.
Hey, what's going on, buddy?
I'm surprised I didn't get a decloaking sound come off on the show.
There's a very good chance you probably will in the final cut. Since you mentioned that, I may have to do that. So, well, what's new with you? I'm sure there's about one or two people that are listening to this show who have no idea who you are, so why don't you tell them about yourself?
I'm Brian Dedimor. I am a avid Klingon fan. I was Lou's core hope for most of the time he's had the Lou Trek show. I was a real good friend of Brian Baker before his passing. I am in Starfleet International now. I'm the executive officer of the USS Indiana Star Trek Fan Club. And I work for the federal government, the United States federal government. Poor me.
Horrible. So when the government stops working and he doesn't get paid, that's when the disruptors really start burning.
Well, one of the nice things about my part of the federal government is I work for the United States Air Force through the Department of Defense. So the only way I don't get paid or I don't go to work is under extreme circumstances and when the military's not getting paid. So if the military's not getting paid, that means nobody's getting paid. Because the one thing that the government does make sure they have funding for is our military people and the people who have to pay them. So I don't get laid off or sequestered that often.
Good. Okay, and one thing I do want you make sure you know, Brian, is that the Lou Trek Show number 213 was just posted here within the last 5 days. And actually, thank you to Paul Wright, who's Captain Furbob. This was Brian Baker's lost show. It's one he did back in December or late November after my dog Minnie died. And it was a great show, but unfortunately, it didn't time out right, and we couldn't use it. Well, Paul did a lot of work on it, and he actually made it sound very good. So it's up there for show 213, so you might want to check it out.
You sent me a copy of it.
Absolutely. Or I'll send you a link.
Yeah, so I have that. Yeah, you sent me something so I could actually download it and listen to it.
Great. And, you know, another reason I bring it up is in our last show, I said it will be done soon. Well, it was done within a matter of 2 days after we recorded that show. I couldn't let it linger anymore. So it is done and it's ready to go. So, all right there, Doctor, why don't you head on into the synopsis?
Okay, the synopsis for tonight's show is Worf's loyalties to Starfleet are tested when three fugitive Klingons come aboard the Enterprise. This is the 20th episode of Season 1 of Star Trek The Next Generation, and the original air date was the 21st of March 1988. It was written by Maurice Hurley, based on a story by Maurice Hurley, Herbert Wright, and Decent Fontana, and it was directed by Rob Bowman. Tonight's guest stars include Vaughn Armstrong, of Enterprise and much others fame, as Corris, Charles Hyman as Conmel, and David Frohman as Kinnera. So, what did we all think about this episode? Now, personally, I'm not the biggest Klingon fan, but I actually really enjoyed this, and I was surprised how much they kind of got right so early on in the season. So how about you, Lou?
I'm going to stay between you and Dedimore if you're not the biggest Klingon fan, because I do see some fighting on the horizon. I will say, I like this one, too. I'd be willing to bet for different reasons than you guys, but we'll get to that. How about you, Brian?
Well, this was the first really true introduction of Klingons back in from TOS, the Next Gen, because, yeah, we had Worf to start off with, but we hadn't really seen the Klingon Empire truly yet from Star Trek Undiscovered Country to Next Gen, and this was the first crossover that we would see with the Klingon Empire. I thought Armstrong did a great job of playing a captain whose mindset is back in the olden days when honor was everything and dying in battle was glorious. And just to watch them work as a team, as a bunch of Klingons, you get to see how Klingons in the olden days, in the early part of Star Trek The Next Generation, acted.
Okay, that's good.
Okay,
that's cool. We'll get into the specific details as we go along. Generally, what we try to do is we'll go kind of in order that the episode goes. I usually take notes as we go on. It's a little bit different than what we used to do in the commentary version because we'd watch it and then talk over it, but you'll see how we go.
So, Lou, do you want to do some forum feedback?
Absolutely. That sounds like a great idea before we get into the show. So, Brian, you have to wait a little bit. Okay, now, we left off.
I think we were on too short a season, if I'm not mistaken.
You were right, because I wanted to say we left off at 1-1. Oh, boy. So, too short a season, got too little of forum feedbacks, but the first one was massive, so I'm going to make you read that.
Okay, sure. We've got another forum feedback from Kieran McDuff, who seems to be a fairly regular poster. Now, it only occurred to me this week that, or at least it occurs to me to ask the question, whether or not, is his real name Kieran McDuff, or is that taken from the show? Because I was rewatching Conundrum last week, and Kieran McDuff is the fake commander that comes on board.
I got a feeling that his name is not really Kieran McDuff. This one is a long one. And actually, he does bring up some points, and I kind of wanted to talk about these points. So maybe we should take those a little at a time. So go ahead.
Okay, so let's crack on with this. So Kieran says, got to agree with the points on this one. The aging aspect of the story was really focused on far too much when there was an open goal of a storyline sitting there for them to use. Doing a deal with one side of a war to give them weapons as an exchange, and then balancing it out by giving the same weapons to the other side. Didn't Kirk do this in a private little war? The Klingons were given arms to one group, so Kirk started to give arms to the other group to address the balance. Okay, it's a slightly different issue, because Kirk was trying to level the playing field, but he's still giving out weapons.
Now, let me stop you there. I wondered about that, a private little war. I couldn't remember that very well. I was confusing that with another one where the ruler's wife, he touched the ruler's wife, and then he was supposed to be put to death, but that's not the one I was thinking of.
That's Friday's Child.
Okay. But I think it still had Klingons in it, and then that's why I was confusing the two. Yes. So, however, I'm not so sure Kirk did give out weapons. I mean, I remember he did show Tyree how to fire one of those flintlocks. But I was listening to the end part when he finally got in touch with the ship. And he said, how long would it take to create 100 flintlocks? To which Scotty's smile went, 100 what? And then he said, serpents for the Garden of Eden. And then he ended it with, he just says, we're very tired, Mr. Spock, beam us up home. And then that was the end of that. So, and I really didn't get the impression that he really did give them weapons. I think he came to his senses at that moment and said, just bring us home. And it doesn't really specifically say Kirk gave out those weapons. Because I know they weren't in contact with the ship during this time, or else after the, what was it called? The Abugatu?
So the Mugatu, right?
Mugatu. Yeah, after he was attacked, obviously, they would have been back up. So it wasn't until the moment that even Spock says we're coming into the time we're supposed to make contact with the captain. So obviously they didn't beam any flintlocks down. They had no idea flintlocks were involved until Kirk asked Scotty that question. But I don't get that they actually gave them weapons in the end.
Do you know what? I'm actually going to be very embarrassing here, and I can't remember a Private Little War other than the Mugatu. And the episode you're describing about the weapons has a vague memory, but is that the same episode as the Mugatu?
The beast in the bad
the
white
beast with
costume.
The horn.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's the same episode.
Yes, because the Tyree's wife was the only one who could cure the Mugatu. What is it?
Mugatu, I think. I think it is, anyway.
The Mugatu's bite or scrape or whatever it was. She was the only one that could cure it, and then you were, like, mated to her and couldn't resist her charms from that point on. I just watched it, actually, about 2 hours or 3 hours ago. And the reason why I did is I thought, you know, I can't imagine Kirk giving out weapons. He was going to. He certainly showed Tyree how to use one. He wanted to balance the power. But in the end, I don't see that we specifically see them give out weapons. It's just he was going to. Whether he actually did or not, we don't know. Ending credits went on.
Okay.
So, go on
Kieran from there. Follows on with, it all comes down to the theory of mutually assured destruction. If you have enough weapons that you can wipe out your opponent, and your opponent has enough weapons to wipe out you, then it's better if you just sit around the table and talk to each other than actually go ahead and wipe each other out. It's a nice theory, but you really need the weapons to be big enough to pull it off. In both cases in Star Trek, that was not the case. So human nature probably would have taken over, and they would have kept on killing until they win. Sad but true. Karnas suggested that if only one side had the weapons, then the 40-year Civil War wouldn't have happened. Well, he's probably right in that, but it would that have been any better? One side would have overwhelmed the other, dooming them to being conquered. Who knows what kind of life the other half would have had? Better to die on your feet than live on our knees, as one Klingon in The Undiscovered Country said. And actually, I think that's always a valid point, right? Mm-hmm. To interject. You can't necessarily just look back on specific time and attribute everything that's gone wrong to the decision that you made, and almost not take into account anything that's gone right. It doesn't quite work like that.
Yeah, you're not Miserian.
No, indeed. Of course, the other aspect of Jameson's actions is whether or not it was justified in the first place. Redressing the balance aside, was it worth handing over weapons to terrorists to free hostages? Well, what other option did he have? The two other negotiators had already been killed, so it's not as if much was working prior to that agreement. But was it worth saving the lives of a handful of Starliner hostages at the cost of so many in a war? Hindsight is a wonderful thing. But if it were me, I would think that without any intervention at all, the 40-year Civil War might have gone on with lesser weapons anyway. It might have resulted in the same number of dead. There's no way to know, and therefore no point beating yourself about it. But yeah, let's ignore all of this and focus on the old man getting younger. Oh no, he's overdosed. He's going to disappear up his own existence or die before he enters puberty backwards anyway. Reverse puberty would have at least made this aspect of the story fun, but they couldn't even give us that. I'm giving this episode a 2 out of 5, if only because it's an interesting concept hidden away in the depth of the age issue. It's somewhere between a 1 and a 2, really, but I'm not needing half marks, so I'll be generous.
Okay.
And I think we pretty much, that's what we said in the episode, isn't it? I mean,
yes.
I think we skirted around the issues and we discussed a lot of this stuff, but if memory serves, I think Kieran has a tendency to agree with us.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least, you know, at least come onto the forums and say that, you know, we've managed to cover a fair number of the sides and hopefully not talking nonsense.
Yeah, you know, as far as the balance aside, it was worth handing weapons over to terrorists to free hostages. I guess my own opinion is no, it's actually not. Because if I was the hostage and I found out that millions of people died just so I could be free, I don't think that's a good takeaway. But who knows?
It's absolutely not a good takeaway, but it's always it's going to be impossible for you to prove causality. So it's going to be impossible for the fact that these have, you know, other than the actual guys that would have died by these actual weapons, it's very difficult to suggest that it has occurred solely because of the intervention. Another thing that does get raised in these issues, it wasn't addressed in the episode, is that if you do negotiate with terrorists, then to what extent is then more likely to occur that terrorists take hostages because they know that they can get something out of it?
Absolutely.
And I think that's more of, I mean, in real life, that's kind of more of the issue that is kind of flagged up.
But one other thing I do want to point out is, like you said, two other negotiators were killed. I think at that point, I'm going to stop sending negotiators. They're not a Federation planet anyway, are they?
No, but I believe that they had ambassadors there, right? Mm-hmm. So there were. Whenever you have this situation in real life, if we can just step back and assume that Star Trek is in real life, if you were to have ambassadors in a country, it's very likely that they have ambassadors in your space as well. And if these guys have taken, you know, your diplomatic corps hostage, then you fundamentally have their citizens on your soil that you can seize as well. We will send diplomats over to countries that we're not necessarily friends with, but there's always this idea that, you know, they have some of our people, we have some of their people, and the diplomatic code is a bit of an honor that can't be broken. So they didn't. The idea of you just having diplomats over there and having to send more and more people to negotiate and be executed when they failed, I don't think it quite rings true.
Yeah. Would you? Okay. If you were the head of the Federation president, and they had our ambassadors, would you hold their ambassadors?
I think to a certain extent, yes, you would.
I mean, okay, they kill our ambassadors. Would you kill their ambassadors? Because I feel like it's not the ambassador that caused the situation. It's not the ambassador we have of theirs. It's their people that caused it. Why would we? I don't think it would be right for me to kill their person because they killed my person.
I think you're getting into territory as well where, you know, the crime on one side is not necessarily the same as the crime on the other. So, you know, we might not have the death penalty, but another country may. And there's a little bit of an imbalance there, right? So there's nothing the Federation would do legally that would allow these guys to be killed. It's not a tit-for-tat response. I think, you know, if you even do look back in history, though, the idea of diplomatic servants or ambassadors being taken hostage and certainly being killed by, you know, other countries would have resulted in war, and it would have been as simple as that. You know, if you kill our ambassadors that are over there, under a tent of agreement or under a treaty, if these guys get knocked off, then that's the end of that. We're coming in. We're going to invade and sort this out. Because I think it's, you know, one of the main, whatever disagreements you might have with various other countries, the ability to keep the ambassadors safe is kind of pretty much number one whenever you have any diplomatic relations with anyone. I mean, the USA will have ambassadors over in Iran. They will be safe. Mm-hmm. And when they're not, it is a huge, huge, huge issue, even away from the standard daily tensions that may exist. Hey, a tangent.
Yes, but hey, you know, I mean, raises some points. So I think we beat that one up a little bit. So let's go on to what I think is a new poster for us, isn't it? Carnivore J?
I believe for us, but I think he's read it. I mean, the poster is active on the forums elsewhere, I believe.
Okay. Well, looking at the picture that's on his profile, I think it might be a he, unless the little girl is the one posting this. But it could be. It says, ah, thank goodness for summer. I'm finally getting caught up on my Trekmate podcast. Good job. Wanted to drop a quick line and say I'm loving this new podcast. Wanted to bring up one thing. You mentioned Picard saying time and tide, Mr. LaForge, and not knowing what it means. Just want to drop a line and say that it is just an idiom for do it quickly. I believe the full statement is, time and tide wait for no man. I've never heard that before. Once I get caught up on this one, I will post a specific response to this episode. Keep up the good work, fellas. Oh, Carnivore, you took too long to respond. I was on June 21st. That was 6 days ago. So I guess maybe I should probably make note of this. So then if you do send a response, we'll put it in a future show. So thank you guys for those responses, and we're sorry we took so much time to go on Kieran's, but there's some good points made up, and, you know, we love to go back and forth with our audience. So unless James has any more, let's go and head on into the show. So let's go ahead and start with the battle in the neutral zone, and guess who's the only ship in range? Now,
The Enterprise.
Now, before people point out the fact that this is Star Trek, it's not real. Although I did have to at one time ask Brian if he thought it was real. But
who, me?
You. Uh-huh.
We won't get into that subject. That was a
That was fun, though.
That was back in the real mess days.
Oh, wasn't it? Yes, yes, it was fun.
That was the Shelby days.
The Shelby days, yes. I still miss him. He was goofy, but I miss him. Okay, so here's the thing, though. Knowing that it's not real, it is science fiction, really, is Starfleet that thin that there's no other ships in the area?
Well, with warp capability ships, ships can go farther out, and I bet you there was probably a ship within a day's warp, maybe warp 7, within a 24 hours of the Enterprise. But they were close enough in the area to be the first one there. So that's where you might run into the closest ship in the area.
Did they mention it's the neutral zone? I mean, getting by the time you're finished with TNG, you assume that they're referring to the Earth-Romulan neutral zone. But is that either made clear, or is that really what they're talking about here?
It could have been a Klingon neutral zone too. I mean, we don't know which neutral zone, because they never truly indicated to us which one it was. We just assume that it's near the Romulan neutral zone, but it could have been the Klingon neutral zone, in which case the Federation isn't going to have a larger patrol. It's going to have that larger patrol out there, because technically back at this time in TNG, we're actually allies, okay, because of the two Kittimer Accord agreements that were put in place. The one from Undiscovered Country and the one after that.
Okay. And, of course, you noticed they mentioned the Ferengi.
The Ferengi?
Yes.
The Ferengi. And, of course, they were meant to be the baddies of the TNG era. But, obviously, they figured that fizzled out pretty fast. So that's when they had to have the Romulans come back. And, of course, I think this episode acknowledges that by mentioning the signature of the weapons being used is not Ferengi, but could be Romulan. Am I getting that right? The weapon signature could be Romulan?
It could be Romulan. What is it? The Borg, Romulan, Ferengi,
well, we didn't know about the Borg,
and Klingons all use a type of disruptor, and each one has got a kind of a unique signature, but they all basically use a variation of a disruptor. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and also I do want to mention that I should have brought up at the beginning is that there is a script blunder that I never noticed until now, and I also have an assignment for Maress, so be ready for that. Okay, so a vessel is drifting. Put it on the main viewer. Next order, magnify. Okay, guys, if you were in control of the main viewer, would you just automatically magnify? Or do you have to be told to do so?
Usually you be told to do so, because it just depends on the captain's view or how he wants to look at it. Okay, he might want to see it up closer. He might be happy with the way he's looking at it now. It could be a number of different reasons why.
Ensign, who told you to magnify? You're relieved of duty. Okay. So Data can scan the ship, and he can tell that life support systems on the ship are failing. Propulsion, navigation, and communication are all inoperative. But the one scan that they actually would need that would make the next 10 minutes completely unnecessary are the life forms on the ship.
Well, I think the Federation, wouldn't matter what life forms were on the ship, they would have went and tried to rescue them anyway. Yeah. So just having the Klingons on board just made it a whole lot more funner, that's all.
Right, yeah. But Picard, you know, calls for life signs, and Worf says, nothing yet. It would appear that there's a great deal of magnetic and radio clutter, perhaps. So maybe someone in engineering is playing a radio that's being held on the wall by a magnet. Who knows? But anyway, it makes you wonder what kind of music they're playing. So, number one prepares an away team, but Lieutenant Yar has to stay at our post just in case the Romulans pay us a visit. Do you think that makes sense, to make the security chief stand by? Couldn't somebody else press the button that says photons?
They could have, but again, it's captain's call.
Right. So,
I think it makes sense. I think it makes sense that Yar stays on board, because she is security, but she's the tactical officer. She's probably best in charge in the event of a firefighter. So I can imagine it being made that way.
Okay, now here are other podcasters, and I disagree. Okay, namely, what's the name of it? Galaxy Class, I think it's called. I listen to theirs, and sometimes I try not to listen to other podcasts, because I feel like I'm cheating if I listen to them. And even if I came up with this on my own, as soon as I hear them say it, then I feel like I'm cheating, because somebody's going to say, oh, you heard that on whatever. But anyway, Mr. The Forge, are we close enough to use a visual acuity transmitter? Here we go. People don't like it.
Okay, here's the first thing on this one. And I joke about this. If they can't scan what's in the ship, okay, that transmitter isn't going to transmit that well on the ship when Geordi gets there. So it's kind of a major complication right off the first bat.
Right. But as far as the concept, here's the thing. I love LaForge. You know, while others either like him, tolerate him, or just plain hate him, but I love LaForge. So, the opportunity to look at life through LaForge's eyes, I think, is terrific.
Yeah, I love it too. But
I think the way they were using it. Yes, the way they were using it here wasn't right. I'm very protective of Geordi. You know, I like some of the work that LeVar Burton has done in the past. Okay, I would rather, if we were going to use a visual acuity transmitter, I would have liked to have seen a Geordi's Day kind of episode. Maybe where Geordi falls in love and we see things from his point of view. But in this instance, I wasn't really up for it. But like Picard says in this moment, looking at all this with the wonder and amazement, I don't know. What do you guys think about the acuity transmitter visual?
I thought they could have done more with it down the line in the show, but I like the fact that they did it, because it gave a little bit of a storyline. You got to actually understand what Geordi's seeing, and you get an idea of how everyone else is having to adjust to what Geordi's spent a lifetime learning to adjust. And Picard kind of caught on to it really fast when he was looking at stuff through Geordi's visor. So it was wild to have to see what Geordi has to look at all the time and try to decipher and try to figure that out and still do his job as engineering, much less did his job as helmsman when he was the helmsman.
Right.
Back in the early days of the show.
Now, I have to say that I agree. I do like the fact that you put like a Geordi point of view shot into the show. I actually wonder why we didn't have more Geordi point of view shots. You didn't have to have his point of view transmitted to the bridge. You could have just gone, you know, in his point of view to see what he was seeing and use it as a technique for, you know, storytelling. The bits where he's looking at the metal fatigue is interesting, and it's, you know, that's, I think that's quite nicely done. I can kind of leave, you know, Picard acting like, a bit like a small boy and getting very excited about this and asking him to look over to Riker and say, "Oh, what's that? What's that?" And I mean, the image we see, it's clearly Riker. And, you know, Picard gets a little bit, in my opinion, a little bit too overexcited. But I certainly like the fact that we have got to see what Geordi sees. And I think they could have used it more without having him plugged into the main viewer.
Well, everybody should get to see this. I wonder if it got piped through the ship, too. Everybody was on their monitors watching what Geordi was seeing at the time. I don't know. I really like the notion of seeing things through his eyes. I mean, what he has to put up with through the constant headaches. And you just get to understand Geordi a little better. So, but here's...
Right. And again, when I refer back, we got to see how Geordi has lived his life, because he had this when he was a very young child. He's had to adapt looking through these, what we were looking at on the screen, and learning how to focus on it and pick it out and be able to tell what it is as if we would visual. And I think it was pretty fun to see what he was looking at and how he described how he knows what certain things are on the screen, where we're trying to guess what we're looking at, too. So, yeah, it was fun to see what Geordi had to go through to get to where he's at now in the Star Trek universe.
Right. Now, I will pull out one thing that they said on Galaxy Class that I absolutely agreed with and laughed at, is that Data and Riker were actually stand-ins. And it's amazing that, what, were they just too busy that day to just stand there and look left, look right? So, but that's just my homage to Galaxy Class. So anyway, Geordi detects that the hull is about to burst. So should I probably would have left at that moment, but do we continue on? And what do we find? Dun-dun-dun!
The Klingon!
Yes, on a Talarian ship. One last thing about the visual acuity transmitter that I would have liked to have seen is what happens during transport. Geordi shuts it off prior to transport. Now later, we do get a feel for transporting through human eyes, but it would have been interesting to see what it was like through Geordi's digital eyes.
Yeah, it would have.
So, or maybe it would have broke down, who knows.
Actually, I think we did one time. Wasn't he hooked up to a probe? And we could see through the probe's eyes.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was one.
And it transported. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you're right there. That's the season 7 interface.
Yeah.
I think you do see him. You do see him go through the transporter.
Oh yeah. Well, then I'm looking forward to that, because I was thinking of Barclay's transporter psychosis episode.
Oh God, Broccoli's. Broccoli's veggie attack.
Yes, pretty much. Okay. Well, anyway, they find the three Klingons, and the ship is blowing! Wasn't that something Geordi did? Okay, Tasha, go to Transporter Room 3. I want you there when the away team returns. Now, why did I mention that? Well, because in about 30 or so episodes, I'm going to be very, very cranky that this line ever came out, and, you know, we'll find out in about 30 episodes or so. We'll go into that further.
So, are you going to leave us hanging there?
Yes, we are.
So, what was the line? Just repeat the line?
The line is, go back. Tasha, go to Transporter Room 3. I want you there when the away team returns.
Okay.
So, let's keep that in mind, because obviously when I talk about that particular episode, you'll find out why I never liked hearing that. Not in this episode, I don't mind. It's the next episode. I do mind, and we'll find out why. Okay, so...
I do have to say, I do like... I mean, if maybe I'm skipping over here, but you know, pull me back if necessary. I do like the fact that when they do beam over, there's interference, the ship's going to be blown, it's obviously hard to transport. She gets them across, but then she loses them, and they end up back on the old ship. And you kind of have this look of, not necessarily fear in the Klingons' eyes, because, you know, the Klingons don't have fear, but you can kind of like see, oh dear, we're in a little bit of trouble here. And I quite like, you know, that would be absolutely terrifying, right? If you were waiting to be beamed over and the ship's exploded and you don't quite make it and you end up back on the ship. I think it would have been better to have like the motion picture happen to you than to end back up on the ship just before it explodes.
Well, I'm looking at it from their point of view and their eyes. I'm going to be rescued. I got a chance for more glory, more honor, and then I get shipped back to certain death. I'm not going to die with honor. I'm just going to implode, and nobody's going to hear my songs of great glory and battles and everything. Yeah, I could see why it's kind of a downer in a sense, which. Yeah, you have to understand, if you don't understand the Klingon mentality back in that time frame, they were the type of Klingons that dying in battle was the goriest thing in the world. For right now, they're kind of feeling a little disgraced because they didn't die in battle, they survived. But the ship's going to blow up, so they can't continue on winning glory for themselves. So it's kind of like a bittersweet victory for them, I guess, is the best way to describe the situation with it.
But do you think maybe when they were transporting and the ship exploded, do you think they felt any heat at all?
Oh, they probably did.
Yeah, maybe a little bit, or maybe I'm curious why some matter didn't transport with them as it was blowing through them at the time. So, what's it?
Well, the pattern buffers would have just got their pattern.
Yes.
Anything else around them wouldn't have came back with them. The only thing it would have came back with the organic matter of the human being, or in this case, the Klingons, okay, that were there. The only problem you might have had with that would have been Data, okay, because Data is inorganic, and then probably some of that stuff would have came back with Data because of his organicness.
Okay. And do you notice the funky Klingon footwear?
Oh, yeah. It becomes very evident about that funky Klingon wear later on down the show.
Right. And, of course, the script blunder is the Picard. He asked why the T'Rallian ship was so far off course instead of the T'Larian ship, but that's been very acknowledged on Memory Alpha and everywhere else, so I won't bring that up. Okay.
Hey, Patrick Stewart has a blunder once in a while.
He's just reading. He's just reading what they put on there. So the third Klingon dies in sick bay, and this is the first time we ever see the death howl. Now, do you think it's conceivable that Worf would have joined in since he was raised by humans since he was a child?
Yep.
So he obviously knows everything about it.
Yep. He's very well. Keep in mind, Worf is very knowledgeable of the ways of the Klingon Empire. He would have jumped in because at this point of time in Star Trek The Next Generation, the Klingons are looking at him not so much, oh, you're wearing pajamas, but they're kind of looking at him as an honorable warrior. Okay. It's later on down the line when we get to interact with the Klingons more, when they start doing the pajama joke.
Yeah.
The running gag pajama joke. But these Klingons have kind of, in a way, acknowledged Worf as a warrior right off the bat. So that's the reason why, they would have had him, he would have howled with them.
Right.
Automatically.
Now, Picard looked confused by this, didn't he?
Yeah, and that surprised me for someone who's supposed to be an expert on Klingons. I was very surprised.
Yeah.
Okay. A blunder they'll fix later.
Yeah, right. Yeah, nice sleight of hand there also. One of the Klingons removes the dead Klingon's boot spike, and of course nobody noticed it. Just us.
Boot spike and another item off of his armor. He actually removed two items.
Right. No special arrangement for the body. Well, no, it's just an empty shell now.
Yep.
Okay, so now,
when I die, I will be going the same way, too.
We learn more about Worf and his foster brother. You know, and I always miss this part. Do you remember when we used to talk about Nicholas, or is it Nikolai? Mm-hmm. What was his name?
Nikolai.
We talked about Nikolai and wondered where the heck did he come from. And actually, here, it's obviously this is the seed for my stepbrother. But one thing I had about Galt, maybe you guys can remind me. I'm looking at Memory Alpha about Galt, and it says in 2347, Sergei and Helena Roshenko moved there with their two sons, Worf and Nikolai. One of the secondary schools on Galt had a soccer team in which Worf captained in 2353 at the age of 13. Worf headed a ball into the goal and accidentally killed the imposing player named Mikhail. That's from TNG Homefront and DS9 Let He Who Is Without Sin. Da 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 da. But I don't remember that part. Do you guys remember that?
Oh yes. I mean, you do remember the DS9 episode, right? Because that's the quote unquote worst DS9 episode where they end up on Risa, and Jadzia is trying to find out why why Worf is so kind of so tense and so prim and proper, and he comes out with that story.
Oh,
so I always remember it. I always remember it in that context.
Maybe it's because I never did it like that episode that I just never really noticed it.
Well, I don't think you'd be alone.
I had to go back. I'm like him. I had to hear it in order to go back to remember it.
Right.
Okay, because I didn't truly catch on to it when he mentioned it here. And it wasn't until that Risa episode that, oh, okay, then I understood more about the relationship between both Worf and Nikolai.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And actually, I mean, rewatching this episode recently, I didn't remember that the story about Worf's adopted parents and the rest of it was placed at this stage. I thought it came later, but it just goes to show that we're only halfway through season one, and pretty much that story about Worf being adopted is in play.
Yeah.
And I always thought that came later for some reason. I thought that's what they tried to add backstory from, in family and stuff. But it's here right at the beginning.
Right.
And actually, I think it works well, by the way. I like it, and I like the fact that it gets brought up here when he's speaking to other Klingons. And to me, it seems natural that this would have come out at this stage.
Yeah. I wholeheartedly agree with you on this. It explains why Worf is there at a time when Klingons would be asking, why are you in a Federation uniform? Well, I grew up with a Federation family because I was found by my adoptive parent, my adoptive father. I think, if I remember right, was he not a Khitomer? He was part of the rescue team that the Federation sent to Khitomer.
Yes.
And that's how they found him.
He was an enlisted man.
That's how
man.
Worf... Yeah.
Okay.
He was an enlisted engineer.
All right. So anyway, the truth comes out that actually what he told, what the Klingons told Captain Picard was actually a lie, and that they actually fought their own people. So Worf reports this to the captain quickly and maybe even puts him in the brig, right? No. Instead, he gives him a tour of the ship, including engineering. Do you think maybe engineering is just a little bit too open to the public?
Yeah, big time. My first instinct is I got a Trellian ship that's been blown up. I got three Klingons on here. Okay, the last thing I'm going to do is show the Klingon Empire or Klingon Warriors Starfleet's engineering room and let them go look around. Let's just show them where it's at in the first place. Okay, come on, guys. You would not take somebody like Klingon warriors who obviously he just found out they were in battle down to your engineering space.
No, you wouldn't.
You wouldn't. I mean, speaking hypothetically as a security chief, that's the last place I'm going to take a bunch of Klingons.
Yeah, especially when we find out that you lied to us the whole time.
Yeah, I mean, come on. Yeah. I mean, if I was Starfleet Admiralty, I'd be asking Picard, are you drunk?
Yeah. Well, put a door on there somewhere. Okay, so we have another ship approaching, and it looks like Klingon, or maybe since the order to magnify hasn't come yet. Oh, wait, there it is. Magnify. Yep, it's Klingon. This can only be a good sign, right? So, now imagine if...
You would think.
Yeah, imagine if Worf had told Picard the truth. You think his reaction to this Klingon ship might be just a little bit different?
Yeah, a whole lot different.
A whole lot different.
Like night and day different.
Okay, so now the captain of the Klingon ship tells Picard the truth that they're renegades. They killed another Klingon ship. Where are they now? They're heading towards us. Yes, the battle bridge. Oh, no, be careful, James. I don't want them taking over the show.
No, I also noticed that. We're on deck 16, is that right?
Is that?
I think it was deck 16.
I'm not sure. Baker would know that. He would know where the battle bridge is. But anyway.
Wait a minute, didn't they go to the brig before?
No. That's what I'm getting at now. Picard sends Tasha with some four security officers, human ones that is, to get the Klingons as Worf, you know, is about to take him to the battle bridge. Let's see here. And as Tasha walks up with the four armed guys, Worf asks, "What's the problem?" Well, you know, it's what they told you before. So, let's see here.
Tasha was worried that Worf was going to join in and join him in the fight.
Yes, because, you know, come on, brother. We got it one last chance. And, you know, he actually was looking back and forth. Obviously, that was to keep the suspense going. But just as Worf is trying to think of joining the Klingons or not, the turbo lift opens and a child runs out directly to the Klingon who picks her up. And then you get it. Bridge, we have a hostage situation on... Oh, here it is. Deck 17, James. There you go. That's your answer. Deck 17.
Yeah. Whoops.
Yeah, it seems Tasha was a little bit presumptuous there. I mean, Klingons don't take prisoners, do they?
They will take prisoners if it's militarily beneficial for them to do so. In this case, the Klingon commander's not stupid. Taking a prisoner like that, if the situation they would have done, would not have given them an honorable death. We've got to keep this in mind as we go through this show. And these Klingons do what they're doing, okay? What they're doing is preserving their honor throughout this whole show. If you can remember that, then you understand why the Klingon let the child go. It is dishonorable for him to die holding a child or using a child as a hostage. It would be dishonorable for him to take a child as a hostage even in the middle of a battle. Okay, unless that child was like the Chancellor's child, then they might keep the kid. But it would be dishonorable for a Klingon to do something like that.
Okay. Do you see a continuity flaw when, by order of the captain, you're going to security? Take them, boys. Obviously, they were taken prisoner. But in Deep Space Nine, Worf says that a Klingon would never be taken captive.
Well, the captain and his other guy, they kind of assessed the situation. And he made a command decision. Yeah, I'm going to take hostage, but when we find out later on, which when we get to later on in this show, it was a tactical decision to surrender. It wasn't a surrender. Right. It was a tactical move to get into a position where they have more control of what's going on. Right now, they're not in control.
A little too
okay?
much.
They're, again, back to the honor thing. It would have been dishonored for them to start attacking now and lose, than to escape and fight their way out. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Of course.
And I think James would agree with me on that point.
James?
I completely agree. The Klingons are in control of the situation when they give themselves up to be thrown in the brig temporarily, because they still have, you know, they still have a couple of aces up their sleeves or in their boots. Mm. So I don't see this as them surrendering. It's them taking control of the situation through their tactical awareness. Yeah.
It's more like up their sleeve, on their boots, on their belts. The Klingon's behind a static force field, so they should be able to contain them, right? goes to show you how bad security is. You know, you got two security officers outside the static force field. Why do they have to have their backs to the prisoners? I mean, or maybe because, you know, some of their cohorts might, you know, approach them, attack them, and let their guys out. Like Worf. He still doesn't know where he wants to go just yet. So, but have one guy with his back to the prisoner and the other guy watching the prisoner.
Well, here's my question. Again, hypothetically speaking, as a chief security officer for a moment. Okay. My question is where are the scanners in security? Security scanners are designed to look for little stuff like emitters, power sources for a weapon, okay, and that little kind of stuff that would have been on the Klingons' uniforms. They should have been detected before they even went in the brig, and they weren't. And I'm like, this is the BS moment of the show, guys.
Yeah.
This is the spoiler notice. This is the BS moment. I'm sorry. If I'm going to be throwing the brig, they should have been scanned before they went in there to make sure that they didn't have the stuff they needed to create a strong enough disruptor to get their butts out.
Or at the very least, maybe they should have been frisks. Maybe they should have been searched. Or better yet, put them in prisoner jumpers. You know, make them strip down into some pajamas, and then put them in there. But why?
If they would took a tricorder and just scanned them,
they're right.
Okay, they would have found the emitters. They would have found the battery pack that was in the boot of the commander, the Armstrong's character. Mm-hmm. They would have found the two pieces that were taken off, which was the trigger and one of the other emitters for the disruptor. They would have found all that. And they did, and that's the BS moment of the day.
Or we could even go back to when they beamed aboard. Why didn't the transporter detect any of these things?
I could see where the transporter might have missed it, but not security.
Yeah.
And to run a security department that bad, Tulsa Yar needs to be brought to the captain and flogged and drawled and quartered for that one. I'm sorry.
If she keeps this up, she's going to find herself dead. So, anyway.
I mean, Worf never even screwed up that bad.
No. Okay, so now back on the bridge, we have Picard talking to the captain, and Worf decides to jump in on the conversation. And here is the mistake made that I'd like Marest to pull out a picture of. As Worf is approaching the view screen, if you look up above his head, you'll actually see the boom mic lowered and moved over for him. So there you go, Marest. Check that out. And you can put that a picture of that on the forum like you did last time. We like to point out things like that because we ain't got anything better to do. Why is it so steamy and smoky on a Klingon ship?
Because a Klingon ship is hotter than a Federation ship. Klingon, if you notice the reason why they have fur and heavy armor, they're like Cardassians. They got to retain their heat, and ships are designed to be a lot warmer than what you would find on Federation standard. The only reason why Worf isn't affected by this, because he grew up in on Earth's type environment, he adapted. But most people going on Klingon ships will find it hot and uncomfortable at first because it's a different temperature range than what they're used to.
I think so.
Okay, Klingons hate cold with a passion. To be thrown on an ice planet is a punishment.
I guess.
So if you're on Roar Pet Day, you really screwed the pooch.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's true, but don't forget, you know, even the guards are Klingon. They must not like it either. Yeah. So, what is Bready in the Bone? It's a little Klingon poetry. What burns in their eyes fires my soul. I hear their words, and I see it all as it was. Part of me longs for that time. And that's when the other ship says, it's called Bready in the Bone. I've never heard that. What does that mean?
I think Britty and the Bone. I'd have to. I'm actually going to have to do something I never thought I'd hear myself say. I'm actually going to ask somebody with a little bit more knowledge in poetry than me.
Okay. Okay, so what do you think?
I think Britty and the Bone is a poem.
Probably.
And what he was quoting was the words from that poem, but I will have to ask my Klingon translator friend who's part of the Klingon Language Institute.
Nice.
Okay. Give me an answer on that.
Good enough. Okay, so what kind of hand phasers do we have on the ship that it takes three hits to put the first Klingon down?
Lowest setting on stun, where you need to get it on the higher setting of stun.
Right. And then when he finally takes him down, what's he do? He stands there, puts his phaser down, so when the second Klingon comes out, he gets to kill him. Yeah, I mean, as a matter of fact, here's another thing. When the first Klingon went down, it was after the first security officer was killed. And then the second security officer kills the first Klingon. The second Klingon picks up the security officer's phaser and shoots the second security officer. So I'm curious, why would it take three hits for the second guy to kill the first Klingon, but it takes one hit of a Federation phaser to put down the second security officer and kill him? I don't think they would have had him on kill. So do you think he really had time?
No, they weren't. They were probably on low stun.
And then when he was able to somehow change it to kill?
Maybe so the security officer was ill.
Yeah.
And it didn't take much to put him over the edge.
Yeah. Well, no. What probably is said on a stunning. You got to remember, the Federation phasers are set at certain levels. Most of the people on the ship are human. Okay? So they probably didn't have time to adjust it up to a higher stun rating. So when the Klingon picked up the phaser and hit the second security officer, didn't kill him, it stunned him.
Well, Tasha said, I have one dead here. She came up to him and she touched him and said he was dead.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right.
So I'm not sure how that came out.
Yeah, it should have stunned him is what it should have done.
Okay, so, yeah, I hate to beat this dead horse, but now Karras has his weapon, and, you know, whatever happened to the computer was able to detect and deactivate everything you've stolen, including this. An illicit weapon has been detected in transport. They didn't do that, but now that he had a weapon, couldn't the computer detect it and deactivate it, or maybe it just wasn't paying attention?
That's what. Remember the time traveler back here? Yeah, it deactivated all the items when he opened the door. It deactivated the phasers and everything. Yeah, why couldn't it have done the same thing?
Yeah.
I agree with you. Okay. That's one of them BS moments.
BS moments. Now, Karras is an engineer and put in a disruptor at the warp core. So, I'd still say the computer could have deactivated the disruptor right there. And did you notice how afraid everybody is of the Klingons throughout this episode? Are we not allies, or do we speak the lies of a talk? Anyway, and I still don't know what I said, because I keep wanting to think it was a tall Kirk, but I don't know. I just had to make that sound so you didn't know what I was really saying, because I really didn't know what I was saying. I would rather die here than let the traitors of Kling pick the meat from my bones. Now, do they really pick the meat from their bones if they die in dishonor?
No, but in what's the version of Klingon hell they do.
I guess so. Okay. All right. And of course,
I don't think Dr. James Robert would disagree with me on that one too.
Probably not.
Too much.
And before anybody yells at their computer or their iPod or whatever and saying, you didn't get the part about the Kling, did you? Yes, actually I did. It's well documented in Memory Alpha, and I'm sure you've heard it before. It was another oopsie. So,
by the way, just as an aside, for whatever reason, one of the episodes that my 6-year-old son has seen of Star Trek is Devil's Due, and one of the only bits of trivia that he knows at the moment is what is the name of the Klingon devil. So, if you go up to this particular 6-year-old and you ask him that question, he will tell you that it's Veklar. And I find that a little bit... Actually, I find that I'm quite proud of that, good, to be honest.
All right.
For the life of me, though, I can't quite remember. What's Klingon hell called?
Greythor.
Greta.
Greta.
Absolutely.
Yep. Okay. So I like Worf in the scene, you know, where's the duty, loyalty, and honor? Your words are meaningless without them. I like the way Worf is portrayed in this episode, and I think, you know, obviously this shows Worf does have potential besides standing in the back and barking and making grunty noises.
Mm.
The Klingon falls through the glass to the next glass level and dies. After a brief growl, Picard reports that all three are dead. Sorry and goodbye. Oh, yeah. They're empty shells now. Do you want them back or what? I'd still like to know one
thing. No, there was one thing that you missed on that.
What's that?
Did not Worf say something about he died with honor?
Yes.
To the captain?
Yes, he did.
Okay. And here again, we fall back to this same thing, this running gag I've been running through this whole show. You got to understand that how these guys did what they did was in a way to show how Klingon honor affects how a Klingon acts or does or what they do and how they do it and why they do it. The captain knew he was going to die. He realized this. He realized that he wasn't going to truly blow up the ship. He was waiting for Worf. He was waiting to see if Worf was going to have the honor to kill him in battle to give him an honorable death. Okay? This is what a good example of how Klingon honor, again, I have to go back, and I'll state this for this time frame, because as we go farther along in TNG and when we get to DS9, we'll see that attitude kind of change a little bit. But at this time frame of TNG, we now see how Klingon honor affects and how a Klingon reacts and does things and why they do things.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yes. You know, and let's not forget about the job offer that gets extended to Worf. You know, when your tour is done, we could use you. And the only thing I could think of is obviously the events of the Kedamar massacre doing of the Duras family have never come out yet, or else they would never have wanted Worf. So,
or they've come, keep in mind, they came out, but were not really publicized.
Right.
Okay, only the High Council knew what happened.
Right. That's true.
And they covered it up.
Yes.
And they covered it up. Kern just happened to be lucky enough to find out something about it. And that's what drew him into the conflict.
Gotcha. Okay, guys. Well, if you have anything else, we got a little bit of time left before I have to go. So let's want to go into the final thoughts and ratings, or do you have something more you observed?
Go ahead, James.
Okay, one very very small nitpick towards the end of the episode, when they have the phaser aimed at the warp core. And I know it's early season one, and I will forgive them, but they refer to it in the clumsy way of the dilithium crystal chamber.
Yes.
And they use those words twice or three times, and it's a lot nicer just to call it the warp core.
Yeah, that's what I called it.
That's the only, yeah. So sometimes you see these things in the early, you know, very early shows where they'll, you know, a common piece of technology will be referred to as something else. I mean, sometimes in the TOS you'll get, you know, shields referred to as screens. And,
yeah.
And you think it sometimes just takes you out because you kind of like know where all of this is heading. The language by the end is almost so fluent that it, you know, these things stick out, I suppose, once you've seen Next Generation 10 times.
Right, obviously.
Yeah.
All right. It's now time to give our final thoughts and ratings for this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. And I'm going to go first. I think this was a fitting introduction to the TNG-era Klingons. Don't worry, Worf is staying, you know. But like I said, I have to wonder how the Kedamar massacre would have been different if Worf had actually joined the Klingons and left the Federation. But the bridge wouldn't be the same without them. The visual acuity transmitter, home frickin' run, my homies. I love the visual acuity transmitter, even if it was only used a little bit, and if, like other podcasts say, it looks like a badly done Photoshop. It still was intriguing. You get to understand Geordi a little bit better. I don't get why people are so afraid of the Klingons on the ship. One mother was shielding her child from the Klingons, and Tasha totally overreacts when one of the Klingons picks up the child, who just looks at him calmly. Only the child seemed to be at ease with the Klingons. The adults, not so much. So, this is the beginning of what will become the Klingon mantra of TNG. Honor, duty, glory. That is, of course, when it's needed. You know, it opens the doors to all future Klingon honor episodes, as well as a Klingon political system that we're going to really get into later. So the importance of this episode can't be understated. We may have never molded the Klingons the way they did if this episode did not happen. So, the visual acuity transmitter and the introduction to the Klingons, even if it will evolve from here, I think this one deserves a 4 out of 5. What about you, James?
Okay, I mean, as I mentioned right at the beginning of the show, I'm not a huge Klingon fan. But I really enjoyed this episode, and I actually think that the more Klingon parts of it were the better parts. I didn't particularly like I liked the technology with the visor transmitted, but I didn't like the way it was executed. I think this is a very good start for Klingon to Next Generation. I think that a lot of the things that we know are going to occur, or we see occurring later on in the seasons, I think they kind of hit them and nail them on pretty accurately at this stage. I like, you know, the Worf interaction with the Vaughn Armstrong Klingon at the end, I think is very good. And to be honest, I think that's it's written in a way that you know that it's Worf. It's Worf's voice, and it's Worf's voice that remains with him for the next 10 years. Certainly, I think it's. I don't think, you know. I think it's clearly him, and it's clearly the things that he cares about. You know, duty, honor, loyalty. I think that considering this is the first bridge of the Klingons into the Next Generation, I would have been fearful that it wouldn't have been handled as well as it is. I was actually, you know, very pleasantly surprised. One other point, I'm under the impression that Worf was always kind of like a last-minute addition mm-hmm. to the crew as they were doing the Next Generation, but I think it's episodes like this that really show that it was a fantastically good idea to have him on board. I think this is, I would go as far as saying perhaps this is the, you know, the best episode portraying the backstory of one of the characters that we've had so far.
You know, let me stop you a second. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you said something. It makes sense. Do you think, spoiler alert, they knew Tasha Yar was going to be written off? They knew Denise was leaving the show, so they needed somebody to step up? Because I think it said in the Memory Alpha that this was kind of a late-written script. So maybe, like you said, they wanted to see if they can draw out Worf a little more.
I'm not sure. I don't know what happened behind the scenes. I think, let's say that Tasha Yar was going to leave. Something like this would help you bridge that gap, of course, right. Bring in Worf more into it. But also, if Tasha wasn't going to leave, having a story like this, you know, with what was originally supposed to be a minor character having such a prominent role, kind of starts to overshadow the other members of the crew. So maybe something like this would have pushed her towards the exit door a little bit more. So overall, I was very impressed. I also like the way that this is a bridge between the, you know, the movies Klingons and what comes later. You know, there is mention about honor, but it's much more restrained at this point. And I'll obviously, you know, we'll see how things go in the seasons, and rewatching, I'll keep an eye out for this. But I get the impression that where the Klingons move to, certainly when the new Chancellor comes in and then you have the Civil War and stuff, that it's kind of like almost a bit of a reinvigoration of the old ways. And seeing these Klingons, to me, in this state, to me it makes sense. historically speaking. So I was actually very impressed, by the way, not particularly big fan of Klingons, and I didn't expect that I would be in this position, but I would also give it a 4 out of 5.
Okay.
This was probably one of the best episodes that I could see that give you a pretty good idea of how the Klingons have slowly come out of, like I said, from the Star Trek movies, from Undiscovered Country to the new era, Next Generation era. We got to see two sides of the Klingon Empire. We got to see the ones who were supposedly in the right and the ones who were the rebels. But even the rebels fought with honor and presented themselves with honor even while they were on the ship. They weren't the rowdy Klingons that we knew from the TOS series. They actually showed honor, restraint, but they were still Klingons. And I liked how they portrayed them in this show, and they did a pretty good job of introducing them into the new Phantom of Star Trek. I would rate this a 3.
Very good, then. All right, well, Brian, thank you for coming on tonight, and
It was an honor.
I've already got you down for Season 2, Episode 20, The Emissary, so if you'd like to come on for the next Klingon episode, I've already got you penciled in.
I will be on the bridge, Captain.
Very good. Okay.
I will decloak and transport down immediately.
Excellent.
Your Klingon brother is always ready for a battle.
My brother from a Klingon mother. Okay, then.
Next time on Star Trek The Next Generation.
Once unleashed, the unit is invincible.
The crew is hunted by a computerized killing machine.
It's one of those things after my ship.
Now the Enterprise is targeted for destruction.
Return fire!
We missed!
Backup system failing!
It's a duel to the death with an invincible enemy on Star Trek The Next Generation.
All right, well, join us next week, everyone, as we review Season 1, Episode 21, The Arsenal of Freedom, with our guest, Blair. I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm Jane from London.
And I'm Brian from Indiana. Kapla.
Kapla, everyone.
Take care. And Baker, we still miss you. Denimore, I know I speak for him when I say we love you dearly. Take care. Good night.
You'll always be missed, my Klingon brother.
That's right.